Okay, K2 Romeo India Whiskey here, with K2KEY. This time we begin the TechNet. We've already got Eugene, Gordon, and Mill signed in. Anyone else like to check in? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
W2 Tango Tango Tango. Good evening, it's Gordon here.
W2PNJ, Bob, good evening. No questions at this time.
W2OSR, and I do have a question.
KC2MDP, Steve, no question. Dick.
KC2RSS in Kingsburg, New Jersey, County of Monmouth. Good evening to all. No questions.
KC2MP, my name is Mario. No questions.
2MAR, Gabe, no questions.
KC2MHY, Canarsie 6 to Brooklyn. No questions, Dick.
Okay, we've got Bob, that's PNJ, Bob OSR, Gordon, checked in twice, we got Gordon both times, Steve with a no, and three or four other guys all with a no. Let's start off with the first guy who I think really has a question, Eugene, W2EWC, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick changed the C to K, Whiskey 2 Echo Whiskey Kilo. The question is, I don't know if you can do it or not. I'd like to know if you could make a receiver that you can listen to the space shuttle with, like you did before. I don't know if that could be yes or no. Could you do it, and how you do it, and where you get the material from, and how you do it? USO?
Yeah, the easiest way to hear the space shuttle is to listen to the repeater on 145.43. There they repeat the space shuttle audio, essentially 24 hours a day when a space shuttle is in orbit. And most of the time now it's visiting the International Space Station. I don't know if there's an easy way to monitor the International Space Station, but you did say space shuttle, I believe. The next step in doing it is to get the right kind of a satellite receiving service. I think direct satellite service, DSS, if you buy the right package, they have a channel which is called NASA Select, N-A-S-A Select, and I believe that is an option you can buy. And they will play the audio for you live, as well as lots of educational material. When a space shuttle is not in orbit, NASA Select, to my knowledge, is on the air 24 hours a day with other space-oriented educational programs. Very good stuff. Almost as good as the Science Channel, so to speak. If you have the old-fashioned kind of satellite system, a TVRO, television receive-only terminal, the 12-foot type dishes, on that, there's also a way you can receive NASA Select. And when you receive NASA Select by that means, there now are, I believe, three separate channels running simultaneously on the same frequency, you could call it, really transponder, what they call it. So they got three educational, they got three programs you can select by selecting the right subcarrier, I guess is one way of looking at it. These are the easiest ways of doing it using commercial equipment. The space shuttle itself, to listen to it directly, and I've done that for extremely brief periods. In the case of the Apollo astronauts, when they're going way out there to the moon, whenever the moon is visible, you aim your antenna in generally that direction, and you can hear what the Apollo astronauts are doing. When you're listening to the space shuttle, it's only 135 nautical miles up above the surface of the Earth. The disadvantage of it is that you have very brief periods of time. If the space shuttle flew directly over your house, from acquisition of signal to loss of signal would be around 18 minutes. And then the vast majority of the orbits around the Earth will miss your house and you'll get nothing. So to set up the electronics to listen to them directly without using one of these satellite services, it's going to be fairly disappointing. So my best recommendation is to find some way that in your neighborhood, Eugene, you can get NASA Select. And now whether or not it's carried on your particular cable company is always a problem. Talk to many of the cable companies in the United States and you'll discover they have all put NASA Select on there for a very brief period of time, like a month or two, and they take it off with the excuse that no one is watching it. Well, by the same token, NBC Television removed Star Trek from their programming way back in 1965 or 66 because they assumed no one was watching it. They didn't realize that in both cases there's a hardcore group of very enthusiastic science-oriented people who represent an affluent chunk of society who were watching that programming and couldn't get enough of it, even though the headcount was not large enough. The bean counters really misunderstood this one in both cases. So I'm a little worried that every cable company doesn't get enough money on NASA Select. It has no advertising. NASA doesn't pay them to carry it. So they just do it for a brief period of time to say that, yes, we've done it. They use that as an excuse to say no one is watching it, and they take it back off and put some other paying material on there. So to find a cable system that will carry it for a long period of time is a bit of a problem. If you're in Texas, particularly in the Houston area, or if you're in Florida, in the Cape Canaveral area, yes, without a doubt, those cable companies will carry it because the local population demands it. But in where you and I live, not enough people are demanding it, Derek. I mean, Eugene. So it could be a little bit problematic. So the best you've got is listen to 145.43, the Lockfield Group. They carry NASA audio. W2EWK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
As long as prosper, W2PNJ.
You on, but I guess you can't do it. And yes, I do have it on my satellite dish, but I was thinking if I can get it direct, I'd be more happier. QSL?
Yep, I was more happier when I was getting the Apollo information on Apollo 15 and 16 direct. I was able to listen to their conversations at times when they were not connected to the network, and therefore I heard more inside information, so to speak, the real science-oriented stuff of what they do on a day-to-day and hour-to-hour basis. It was fun. But in case of the shuttle, I was listening to the astronauts while they're going to the moon, way out there in space, and therefore they're looking at half of the Earth all at once. Whereas when a space shuttle flying at 135 nautical miles altitude flies over the Earth, it's only looking at 1% of the Earth at any one period of time. I don't know the exact number, but it's a very small number. And only if that particular orbit flies directly over your house are you going to be able to hear anything. And even then, you'd have to have a tracking antenna because they sweep across horizon to horizon in 18 minutes. So it's troublesome, Eugene. It's a good challenge. I didn't say give up. I'm just letting you know what the challenge is ahead of time so you don't launch into this with over-expectation. So if you do follow through with that, other than getting it on your cable TV system or your satellite system, let us know what you find out on that one, Eugene. Bob, W2PNJ, I think he said no, but let's give him a chance anyhow. Mr. PNJ, do you have any questions or comments? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks for Tango Tango.
Okay, Dick, you touched
the
soft spot when you mentioned Star Trek. That's why I said live long and prosper. No, just saying that I really missed that series. I'm very, I was very up on that. A lot of trivia, and I really enjoyed it very much. I'll be on the side listening. Regards to everybody on the net.
Okay, Gordon's next. Gordon, your signal, I think you're mobile, and your signal is fairly choppy into this repeater tonight. And so I think you haven't heard when I was telling you that, yes, you did sign in. But let's give it a try. Whiskey 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. Gordon, who is one of the main people on the TechNet in New Jersey on Thursday night. You've got it, Gordon. K2RIW in the TechNet on Long Island.
Yes. And exactly as you described, I've been around to where there was a package of three channels, and I wonder if you mentioned my point was from the moon. Anybody else had to listen on 2200 megs, I guess it is, the Japanese lunar orbiter.
Okay, I was listening to you both on the input and the output. Now, believe it or not, out here on Long Island, I'm getting better copy of you on the input. But I'm using a Yapi that's aimed right in your direction, Gordon. Yes, there is a Japanese satellite, and if you are a subscriber to the W1, well, because I can't think of Tom Williams' co-letters. My mind's gone blank on that one, but there's a microwave reflector where quite a few of the people signing in have been listening to the 2 gigahertz signal of a Japanese satellite that's in a polar orbit around the moon, and they're listening to the 2.2 gig signal on their 2304 megacycle ham radio transmitter, and quite a few of them are hearing it quite well with very simple equipment. Some guys are listening to it with an extremely small dish or a horn. They're only getting the carrier. But by listening to the carrier as a function of time and listening to the Doppler shifts and knowing that it's a signal coming from a quarter of a million miles away, it's kind of a fun thing to do. So what I think Gordon is bringing to our attention is that this Japanese satellite, although I can't think of the name of it, is listening to, it's a signal that's fun to listen to. It's got subcarriers at around 15 and 16 and a half kilohertz above and below the main carrier. So if your system has enough threshold, you can listen to those subcarriers, which is about the way I listen to the Apollo astronauts. Their main downlink signal from the command service module was on 2287.5 megahertz. That was Apollo 15 and 16. All of the Apollo spacecraft were on that frequency. And then if you listened 1.25 megacycles above and below that frequency, you were listening to the subcarrier that contained astronaut audio. And roughly 1.04, I think it was, megacycles above and below, was the telemetry information. So there were various subcarriers on the main carrier that when you tuned across the receiver, you just thought you heard an upper sideband and a lower sideband. Then you put a receiver on that upper sideband, demodulate the FM audio, and there was astronaut audio. And you're listening to Warden, Irwin, and Mattingly, Young, and Duke. These are the astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16 that I listen to. Kind of fun stuff. So I wonder, do you have a setup capable, or if any of the people in New Jersey are capable of listening to that signal, Gordon? Whiskey 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. K2LIW on the TechNet on Long Island.
I was at the double game and anxiously getting into the car in time for your net. Let's see. No, I'm not. I'm embarrassed to say that I have a 3-minute transmitter put up for 3-4 pairs from that date that I bought years ago and played with a few times. And it's in a box somewhere, or it got thrown out, but I have not been able to find it on my property yet. I still have lots of boxes to go through after the remodeling, and you know, there's a limited number of places to go look. Meaning that, you know, if I start ripping open boxes, it opens up other issues that I got to then deal with what's in that box. And so there's only so much time and effort you can have for those kinds of things. Recently, I found some halos that were brand new in a box, so I've got that squared away. So things are starting to appeal, you know, come back. But what I heard was the guys were using broadbanded receivers, like let's say an IC7000 or an IC746, to demodulate the stuff, but or at least to detect it. The data apparently is in Japanese, so it's not real significant to us, but it's very cool nonetheless. The guys were using the 2304 gear, by the way, and just dealing with the fact that there was plenty of gain, residual gain in the system at 2200 change. And there, as you said, they were using very modest antennas, sometimes patches and horns. Horns directly and patches in front of some very small dishes. It was very impressive. K2AW2GTG.
Very fine. Gordon, the information you just gave us, you're getting that from what source? Is it Dr. Tom Williams' microwave reflector? Back to you, Gordon.
Yeah, it is. I apologize. I don't know. Is this call still WA1MBA or am I brain dead? I just can't remember a newer call.
No, he hasn't changed his call. WA1MBA, Mike Bravo Alpha. And you've recovered my rusty memory on that. And I was just in front of Tom 2 or 3 weeks ago at the microwave update that took place in Philadelphia. And he and I had some good conversations. For quite a period of time, Tom, WA1MBA, held the distance record in the United States for 120 and 140 gigahertz ham radio two-way QSOs. So his microwave reflector represents people who are very interested in the world above 1,000 megacycles, and they do experiments like these. What's interesting is that when a human ear is listening to a weak signal in the noise and it's a steady carrier, it's kind of amazing how weak that signal can be, and you can listen to it. If you're using one of these spectran displays, a spectrum analyzer waterfall-like display, by looking at the variation of color of the snow that's on the screen, you very easily recognize that little white vertical line that represents the carrier that's been there for a period of time. And by watching that line drift to the left and to the right, you can see it's a Doppler shift as the satellite goes around the moon. This particular satellite, I think, is in a nearly polar orbit, obvious by the fact that people are claiming they hear it for the complete orbit. I know when I was listening to Apollo 15 and 16, while the lunar module, or the lunar rover or the command module was in orbit around the moon, roughly 1.5 hours was each trip around the moon for therefore something like 45 minutes there would be on the front side of the moon, you could hear them. And then for 45 minutes, it'd be on the backside, and you couldn't hear them. And as the signal went around the edge of the moon on the left-hand side, as I call it, you and I would call it the eastern side, Earth-oriented, they went around the moon in a clockwise manner, even though their orbit around the Earth is a counterclockwise manner. And in space, they draw a figure eight in the process of going there and coming back. As they go behind the moon in the clockwise manner, you hear a very high negative Doppler shift, which starts becoming a little bit positive just as the signal gets behind the moon. And you also hear a couple of very funny effects because of grazing angle signals off the edge of the moon only for a fraction of a second or so. And in my case, because I was further east of Goldstone, which was their uplink, the system then went into the search mode for a number of seconds while the shadow of the moon swept across the Earth, starting in California and sweeping toward New York. So for the next 10 seconds or 15 seconds, as I remember, I would hear the spacecraft go into a search mode where the signal would swish back and forth, looking for the uplink to lock onto. And so during that period of time, I was hearing the Apollo astronauts when Goldstone was not hearing them. Kind of a fun operation. So it sounds to me like you're moving in that direction with your 2304 converter, Glenn. And what's your best guess as to when your system might be capable of listening to the Japanese satellite? And again, replace my memory of what's the name of that particular satellite. Whiskey 2, Tango, 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 KQRIW.
Okay, Dick. Let's see. Well, if I find my transverter, I should be able to do it pretty quickly because what I would do is I would just simply put a polar mount up very quickly. I have an azimuth rotated, it's ready to go, and I would just go up and quickly throw a polar mount at the moon and leave it at that. It would probably give me a couple of days worth of listening just across that arc without any trouble, just by setting the elevation right on the rotator. But ultimately, I'll have an Azel Gizmachi going. I have a C-band disk drive which has about 20 inches of movement, and I have to decide what I want to put on that drive. But I have a 3.5-inch rotatable mast through my house that is now operational with a 50-year-old custom rotator. So I'm going to put that to work. So we'll see. I mean, and my coaxes are short, and the best part is that I'm looking at making them shorter because I think I can run the coaxes through the mast. I think I'll be able to actually pull that off, which would be very cool. but that's a future step is to have the mast, you know, 13 feet through the shack roof to the dish, so maybe 20 feet of hard line down through the mast, etc., and then put some sort of flex cable at the junction underneath the mast. So we're going to see if we can get that to work in the future. I know they make really cool couplings, but that's thousands of dollars I don't have, and finding one surplus is probably out of my league, and I'm probably just going to settle for 7/8 Teleax for 20 feet and just live with it. But that's the design goal for the system. I don't know where my transverter is. That's the real hard problem, and I just don't know what to do. Anyway, we'll probably be at our food stop, after a little bit. But I don't remember the name of the satellite, but I can tell you this, that it's about 30 milliwatts I'm hearing, 30 to 40 milliwatts, and people are hearing this thing from the moon. So that tells you how good our systems have gotten for relatively modest installations.
Very fine, Gordon. Yeah, as long as you've got a preamplifier somewhere close to the antenna, overdriving both the insertion loss of the cable, which then almost wouldn't matter, and overdriving whatever noise figure of your barefoot 2304 converter has, that would help an awful lot. I wonder if you've talked this up with the guys in New Jersey on your TechNet on Thursday night, if any of the others are oriented toward doing this. When you do it, I'm sure they're going to develop some excitement and want to go do it. Also, you're now tracking something that's in orbit around the moon, and it's only moving plus or minus half a degree vertically and horizontally as it goes around the moon in a near polar orbit. You're probably going to be using an antenna with 10 or 20 degrees of beam width, so the half degree of moon motion, so to speak, is nothing. Therefore, you're essentially tracking the moon, and the moon only sweeps across your sky in New Jersey. And here in Long Island, it sweeps a little bit faster. That's a joke. But in New Jersey, it sweeps across the moon, the sky, 14 and a half degrees per hour. Therefore, you could set up an Armstrong rotation system. Simply lock the antenna down on a tripod in the backyard. Once every half hour or an hour, you go out there and reorient it a little bit with a bore sighting tube, so to speak. So you don't even need the Azel rotator to start the operation. I've done some of that with Oscar 10. When Oscar 10 satellite was up at its apogee, it moved so slowly across the sky, about the rate at which the moon moves across. And therefore, I never did put on the tracking motor, just went out there and moved it periodically. This is the second or third time I've talked to you on Sunday night with your family in the car. I'm going to make a rough guess that you visit the in-laws or the outlaws on Sunday afternoon, and on the way home, we hear from you. W2TTT, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, what usually happens is at 8 o'clock, I'm either concluding a scouting... at least this fall anyway, a scouting religious emblem program or taking one of my sons and usually one or more of his friends to a devil game in this case, because we didn't have a session for the what they call Adultari Day class tonight. So that's what I was doing. But yeah, I got kids in my ears all the time. You know, my youngest is 11, my oldest is 21, and the one who's a ham is 19. That's K22NZC. But thank you for asking. So yeah, I always seem to have kids who are of scouting age in my car these days, because I still have one. And it's a blessing to behold. But anyway, and we're working on one and three to get their licenses. So, but my wife is into FWI, by the way. Nancy's had her license for forever. She took her tech back when it was really the general written. So she could, if she just applied for a general, she could become one. Anyway, enough of that. But your point about the moon not moving very much day to day, even, is why I suggested a polar map, because that way I can, you know. I could probably maybe every 10, 20 days go out and adjust the declination and on the polar mount and be done with it. If I really wanted to just do that, I could drive that pretty well. So I have choices, but my backyard doesn't have visibility to anything other than buildings. That's the problem, so gotta be on top of that. Anyway, pray that I find my transverter, and the goal is to mount the transverter, by the way, up top outside, right? It's just in the back of the dish, because I can do that too. But for some of the other bands, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to run hard lines ultimately down through the mast, along with some flexible coax for the back of the transverter on 2 meters. 7-3 for now, I'll just listen now. K2RW W2TTT.
Okay. I think your wife's name is Barbara, but I'm not sure. Alrighty. My guess is you're going to be talking it up with the guys in New Jersey, and some of them may join you, particularly when you become successful with that operation. Listening to a spacecraft that far away at 250,000 miles is kind of fun. I know that during the Apollo missions, I was listening to the ALSET packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package. Something like 4 of those, I think, were put on the surface of the moon. Very similar S-band frequencies. Unfortunately, they got turned off. I wish they didn't, because they're such weak signals, I'm sure they weren't jamming anybody or creating any real grief. And they were very interesting beacons to listen to from the lunar surface. Good luck with that project, Bob, and Gordon, and tell us from time to time how it goes. Let's see, now, I'm not sure if Bob said yes or no, W2OSR, but let's give him a try. W2OSR, what would you like to add to this one? This is Jazz, K2RAW in the TechNet.
W2OSR, good evening, Dick. I'm going to come down to a little bit lower frequency. I'm just curious if anybody has any information on the Cobra antenna. I've tried modeling it on CNET, and what I've seen does not please me, but it's very difficult to model. The other thing is I did contact the company, or the gentleman that makes it up in New Hampshire, and really want to give out as much information about the antenna, so that means that if you model it, he probably knows that it looks the way I've been seeing it, or just never got around to doing it. We'll see what kind of feedback we get out of there.
Okay, interesting. The Cobra antenna, and out of curiosity, Bob, is it a 2-meter antenna you're discussing? I should know and I don't. You got it, Bob.
No, it's supposed to be a multiple band HF antenna. And you got the name of Cobra because the wires look like the letter S kind of greatly flattened out, hence the snake shape. It's like a traditional dipole. From the outer end, it comes back in towards the center, turns around and goes back out again. So it's 3 wires in a continuous folded back on itself type pattern. Over.
Interesting. I've been experimenting over the last week at a UHF frequency of an antenna that has some of those properties you just described, Bob. Also, the so-called isotron antenna. Versions of it have a lot of folding. I think there's a version that goes all the way down to 40 meters. So a lot of folding, and it can be placed in the shack with you. So when it comes to the Cobra antenna, I'll bet you the guys at Kings County Radio caught the fiddle with that one. And if so, their president, Mel, K2KEY, is going to tell us a little bit about that. So what do you hear about that particular antenna and people who have tried to model it, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Good evening all again. This is K2KUY. You know, I can't recall something about the Cobra antenna. It's not coming to me this moment, Dick. I am trying to remember something. Somebody mentioned something in a previous, but I can't recall. I get one of these, also one of these senior moments that, you know, I get so much paper things piled up all the time. And sometimes it just momentarily skips my mind, but maybe it'll come back to me a little later, then back to you.
Very fine. I think you've turned up your audio a little bit since I last talked to you, Mel. It sounds good. Bob, your audio is a little bit lower than it should be. Maybe you've got to shout a little louder into that mic or eventually turn up the gain a little bit. Or maybe you're not trying to wake somebody up in the house. On other people on frequency, if they have any knowledge of the Cobra antenna, good, bad, or otherwise, or even secondhand knowledge, give us a call, let us right now. Let's hear about it. K2LIW listening. I ain't hearing anything, Bob. It's like we're a little light on knowledge on that particular one. You may be the expert in the area. Hey, Bob, what is a cobra antenna? How well does it work? W2OSR, K2LIW.
That's W2OSR. It wasn't an antenna I had even considered looking at until I was up at HRO in Salem, New Hampshire over the holiday weekend. And the guy in the store said, oh, this thing is great. Showed it to me. They're actually using it as an antenna for the store for some of the bands that they can't cover with their beams. I'm still not going to buy one because I didn't like what I saw. Talk to somebody else tomorrow night, and we'll see if we can work out the modeling on that and get some better information on it. For now, it's you know, sounds good on paper, doesn't look good when I model it.
Yeah, you got to be careful though how you model things. I know that in the case of the most elaborate modeling program that people use for very wild structures on microwave frequencies, HFSS, High Frequency Structure Simulator, which for a short period of time was a Hewlett-Packard or Agilent product, and various people have owned that company. You have to take a course that goes on for a number of days to find out how to really properly put the data into the program. But and I think it's a, when you buy all the goodies with it, I think it's a $50,000 program. So you got to be pretty serious to own a thing like that. Almost no amateurs own it, but a number of amateurs have managed to borrow it periodically on their lunch period, so to speak, at their salt mine and things like that. And they've done modeling, and it'll do animation. In the case of a signal flowing down a feed horn with various diameters of the horn, you can watch the signal flow and watch the mode being developed and see how it comes out of the horn and flares over to the side and crawls down the outside and so on. Kind of a fun animation to watch, the radio waves propagating. We know we do it. We know it does it. We see the result. But obviously, other than a computer-generated animation, no one ever really sees it happening. Of course, it's a slowed-down motion picture. In real life, it would travel every nanosecond. It would travel a foot, and you wouldn't see anything. You wouldn't see anything if it was a million times slower, but you understand the principle. So it looks like we have to dig a little bit deeper on the Cobra antenna, Bob. And when you do find something about it, let us know. I imagine I can Google those words and I'll be able to see a picture of it. It's probably a product that's been around a while. Let's hope that somebody has actually used it and liked it. Once again, I got to keep coming back to a philosophy, or a fact, as I call it, of miniaturized antennas. Every one of us wants to put an antenna from time to time on our property where we don't have enough property. I mean, anybody putting up a full halfway dipole in 160 meters, unless you've got a couple of acres of property, you ain't got enough property to squeeze all that antenna onto your property. But there's various ways you can electronically keep it the same length, but mechanically make it smaller. Loading coils at the bottom, middle, or top. Zigzagging it. Moving it in three-dimensional space in various kinds of zigzags. Top hat loading capacitors at the end, and so on. There's many techniques for making antenna smaller and smaller and squeezing it on your property. You tune across the 20-meter band any day of the year, and you will hear somebody saying, gee, I made the antenna smaller, therefore it has a smaller capture area, therefore the gain is going to be much lower, therefore I'm not going to hear as well. Good-sounding common sense. Unfortunately, it's dead wrong. As you guys have heard me say from time to time, you read the chapter in the really good book, whether it be the Antenna Engineering Handbook or Krauss's book on antennas, and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal size dipole. I mean, you can make a dipole only a couple of percent long compared to the length that it should be. And once you re-resonate that, and it may not be easy, but once you resonate that antenna, electronically, you duplicate the 85% of that area, so to speak. You lose 4/10 of a dB of gain when the antenna becomes zero in size, as it approaches zero in size, as long as you can keep resonating it. The antenna Q is going to become very high. It's going to become very narrow band. Every time the QSY 10KC up the band, you're going to want to retune your antenna tuner when you have an antenna like that. But still, you should be able to, with good materials, get full performance. So assuming that the Cobra antenna is not made out of carbon granules or nichrome resistive wire, as long as it's made out of good materials, you may not like the radiation pattern where it stores most of its energy. You may not like the bandwidth, but the efficiency should be there. So if it's an antenna that's small enough that fits into your property and is not super expensive, it may be better than you think, Bob. Back to you for any quick comments on that one, Bob. W2OSR, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2OSR. Well, first of all, it's about $90, so it's not horribly priced, but 5RV is cheaper, obviously. One thing just to make it easier for you when you go to try and Google it, look under Granite State Antennas. Maybe a little bit easier to find it that way, Dick.
Good information, Bob. Granite State Antennas. Sounds like it's a New Hampshire product or Vermont, one of those Granite States. You talk to the hams I know up there, and for them to establish a good ground, it's not easy. They got granite everywhere under their tower. And try to find a place where you can sink a ground rod without running into rock, where you can find a crack between the rocks, get down to something that's conductive, is from time to time challenging. The good news is what those guys do is they put in rock anchors instead of screw anchors for their guy wires. They drill a hole of the right diameter in the right direction, and there's an expanding kind of a rock anchor where you put it in the hole and twist it just right, and it's got this cam lock mechanism that slides two pieces of metal past each other, and it becomes wider in diameter and jams itself into a hole. That's one kind of an approach. Another kind of approach, they got some kind of a super epoxy they send down the hole, and that literally glues the screw anchor in place. That one scares me. Yes, there are some modern epoxies that are very, very good, but if you get water going down a hole and the water freezing and pressing with ridiculous pressure against that epoxy, and epoxy itself is a chemical that keeps hardening and eventually becomes brittle, so I worry about a failure of that bond. There are a number of times when I've put together microwave antennas that are held together temporarily with epoxy glue, and I hung them on my tower, and a month later, pieces of that antenna were laying on the ground because the epoxy glue with ultraviolet exposure became brittle and came apart, and the antenna fell apart. So when it comes to life and limb that's really required to be maintained by way of the guy wires of your tower, to me, the most important component of a tower is the guy wires. And I inspect them periodically. I want to make sure they're in very good shape because they literally keep me alive when I'm up on that structure. Okay, let's see. Steve, I think he said no. Gordon, we've already covered. Is there anyone else who signed in with a yes? Because it happened a little bit fast. I didn't get a chance to write them all down. Anyone else who signed in with a yes? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW for TechNet. Looks like we've got a slightly late night tonight. I didn't hear Paul, WS2N, sign in yet. Paul, are you there, WS2N? Did I hear you say something, Paul? Yes, I did not. Hey, Mel, it's just you and me tonight. You, me, your latest experiment, plus your mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, the only experiment, what I do, oh, yes, on the experiment I was doing with that vertical guide pole, we did more or less almost finished the discussion on it last week. The only thing I did do, Dick, I wanted to make one more test. And what I did is I used my, I have a nice little bridge made by to have some negative signals. Oh, God, I can't say enough. That measures return loss. And I put the generator on it. And they only have to put about 10 milliwatts into the bridge. And I wanted to see if return loss in some way coincided with what I was seeing the previous week when I was doing those experiments. I didn't bother pulling the dipole back up, you know, into that position where it was 66 feet on one end and 45 on the other. I just was experimenting with it at the angle of it was making with ground, about 66 degrees, and seeing the variation there. I'm figuring that by measuring RL, return loss, I would be able to get somewhat of a more of a sensitive reading on what was going on, because I was using a Putin RF meter on it, and it sort of more or less told me that for some reason the angle coming down is more or less correct, because I was measuring a return loss of about 11.5 dB with it when it makes 66 degrees to the ground. If I moved it around, I could not get anything better than that 11.5 dB. It would drop off. Just some of the angles weren't that much different, and yet I would drop off by 8.5 dB. So that's, something I was thinking in the back of my head, that measuring return loss rather than fooling around with SWR and things of that sort. If that is maybe a more definitive way of measuring an antenna or a deck, what do you think of using return loss? We seldom ever hear it mentioned, over.
Could be true in your particular case, Mel, but in general, it is not true. When you send a signal down a transmission line, the craziness of a transmission line is the signal goes down there in one direction, like water going down a pipe, and if and only if the far end of the line is a pure resistor of just the right impedance, like 50 ohms for 50 ohm cable, or 70 ohms for 70 ohm cable, or 300 ohms for 300 ohm friendly, as long as the resistor is a pure resistor of the right magnitude, which is called the characteristic impedance of that transmission line, then and only then there will be no reflected energy. The S11 will be as a hard number, zero, or in decibels, minus a great big number of decibels, like minus 40 dB. So impedance matching of the transmission line is all that you're measuring when you measure the return loss of an antenna system with feed lines. Now, there are extremely high-performance antennas that under one particular operation might give you a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, where the power being reflected back is only a dB or two weaker than what you send out. But of the amount of energy the antenna radiates, it's radiating it with high gain in the right direction. So a very high-performance antenna that has a poor impedance match and feed on could have a huge amount of gain, and your reflected power would tell you it's a terrible antenna. Conversely, I can take a high-performance antenna, I can put a great big resistive box around it of anechoic material, so I'm absorbing everything that from the antenna. It doesn't get a chance to get radiated in space, but because I'm absorbing all the energy, again, my return power would be a small number. In that case, return power, small number, sounds like it's a good antenna, but because it's inside of an anechoic chamber, it's not radiating into space, and it's a terrible antenna. And the previous example I gave is a poor reflection coefficient antenna that has high performance. So my best assumption that I told an awful lot of people, with rare, rare exception, reflected power or standing wave ratio and antenna gain are almost completely unrelated. Now, they do come back to a relationship between each other, because Number one, a modern-day solid-state transmitter is not going to tolerate much more than a 1.8 standing wave ratio before it starts going into its self-protect mode, cutting back its power, turning itself off, flashing the lights on the front screen. So you need low reflective power just to keep your modern-day solid-state no-tune transmitter happy. And you want high performance because you're listening to that great DX station, you want to get into that pileup, and you want the guy to hear you. So, under that circumstance, yes, in your particular shack, the two functions are related to each other. But when it comes to pure measurements, I think they are 99% unrelated. And so, high performance in one tells you nothing about the other. Low performance in one tells you very little about the other. The slight exception to that rule is as your standing wave ratio becomes extremely high, your reflective power at first would suggest it doesn't get a chance to be radiated by the antenna. Well, there's a catch, and that is almost all reflective power from an antenna coming back to a modern transmitter, that power does not get absorbed by the transmitter. Almost all of our transmitters, whether it be a solid-state device with a transistor in the final stage, or a pentode tube, or a triode tube, more the pentode tube, or the tetrode tube, these transmitters are nearly a constant current generator. They generate power. They generate power with the right amount of load resistance on them. They'll do it with a good amount of power and a good amount of linearity, particularly in the sideband service. However, because they are nearly an open circuit, constant current generator, they cannot absorb power that's reflected back to them. So therefore, the power reflected back to your transmitter, 90-some-odd% of it gets re-reflected forward. And it gets a second, third, and fourth chance to finally be radiated. So even with a high standing wave ratio antenna, a simplistic approach, assuming your transmitter is a pure 50-ohm source, you would think all the reflected power gets absorbed and turned into heat and wasted forever. In reality, it gets a second, third, fourth, and fifth chance to be re-radiated. And so, in many a circumstance, an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna can be an extremely high efficiency antenna, as long as you've got low enough loss in the feed line that can tolerate that signal bouncing back and forth quite a few times from that feed line before it finally gets radiated. So, you can see that my philosophy on this one, Mel, is that 98% of the time you're going to be right if you assume that reflective power and antenna performance are essentially unrelated. I'm convinced that that's a heck of a lot more true than not true. And you might have another opinion on that one, Mel. W2, K2KUI, K2LIW.
Oh, of course, definitely. This is K2KUI. Of course, definitely that the SWR indication of the antenna is not a criteria of how well the antenna is really going to perform in the so-called real world. The point I was just trying to make out that I had with the dipole, of course, the SWR stayed very constant, about 1.7. No matter how I had the dipole, whether it was in the vertical position, the somewhat sloping position, or pulled back up in the horizontal position. The only thing I could see was because I had the band scope on the receiver and listening to a DX station, was able to evaluate what seemed to be as the best position on the antenna. However, like I said, that as long as the SWR didn't budge at all, really, to speak of. However, the only difference is I really saw any kind of pronounced difference. If I really want to say something, I was able actually to peak the performance, if you want to call it peaking the performance in any way, is by measuring the return loss in this case and setting this antenna, the slope of this antenna, actually, I moved a little this way, I was actually trying to squeeze every little bit out of the measurement, and it was able, as just moving a little bit, you know, go from like 10.7 dB to 11 dB to 11.2 to 11.5, Dick. So it's strange that I was able to see the pronounced change in it strictly by measuring return loss, over.
Now, when you're saying the pronounced change, this was while using a modeling program, I think is what you said, Mel, and you correct me on that one. And I guess you believe you've got a pretty good model for the conductivity and dielectric constant of your particular soil in Manhattan Beach. Is that true, Mel?
Let me tell you something about modeling programs. I guess that's what you were sort of mentioning earlier. You got to take the modeling program with really, I think, say, a grain of salt, because the soil condition, I don't know how to really factor in the soil condition. God knows what you got here. First of all, you got to remember in an urban area like this, suburbia, called suburbia urbia, and you got houses around here. You got the drain pipes, copper gutters, street lights, power lines, you name it. So, you know, these modeling programs basically, I think, were, you know, really laid out where, under the best of circumstances. So, how do you really model? How do you factor in the soil conductivity situation? Well, you look on a map and they tell you what, you know, expected your area, but again, I don't think that's really ideal in doing any real antenna work. I think you've got the right idea when you say get out there, make it, get out there and give it a try, Dick, over.
Yeah, when it comes to a person who's just got his ham radio license, he thinks he is being faced with a large number of extremely important critical decisions. What transmitter should I buy? Which one has the most power output? Which one has the best receiver? Which one has the best horns and whistles on the receiver and digital signal processing? What feed line should I use? What antenna should I buy? What tower should I buy? How high should I mount the antenna above the ground? Like I may have already said, what feed line should I use? How should I match the antenna? It seems like there's a whole lot of very important decisions to be made. Common sense makes you think that if you make a wrong decision there somewhere, the whole system is going to come crashing down and not work, and you waste a lot of money. With rare exceptions, particularly if you talk to some of your friends and you use a recommendation of somebody who's been around for a little while, you'll discover that used rigs, even the one that's been thrown down a flight of stairs and it's got a dented front panel, as long as it works, and Andy, the ATCDL, helps you get it on the air electronically. It may not be a beauty, but if it's on the air electronically, you're there. A simple antenna, a wire dipole, and you and I are slowly concluding that a vertical dipole has got a very unpopular antenna, has a lot to offer over a horizontal dipole. But a horizontal dipole, don't not get me wrong, is a damn good antenna. So you start off with something darn simple, without even worrying about the details. You put it up, you start talking to people. Once the system works a little bit, and you can talk to people, you tell the first guy you talk to, I'm using a so-and-so antenna, it's so many feet in the air, and there's a 50-50 chance that on that first day you're going to find somebody who's done something similar. He says, yeah, I started off with that, it worked pretty well, and then I did this with it, and it worked a lot better. So just make the leap of faith. You can't go wrong. With rare exception, the rig is not going to explode, the antenna is not going to burn down, and the neighbor's not going to run you out there with tar and feather out of town. So just go do it. Start off. I mean, any one of these decisions about ham radio, you can cogitate or you can mull them over in your mind for months on end, or you can spend a day and say, what the hell, I'm going to put my foot in the water and just go and find out what happens. And with rare exception, you can't go wrong. So we're all on a learning curve. One of my philosophies is that inside of each ham radio operator, there really is a scientist trying to get out. He wants to understand how this radio stuff, action at a distance, how does it really work? Why does it work so well? Why does it not work so well when you want to demonstrate it to somebody? Why is there a Murphy's Law? So we're really fervently pursuing a goal that is not clearly defined. That's what ham radio operators are doing. We're tinkerers. We're minor scientists without the doctorate degree and without the Brookhaven National Laboratory or Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory backing us up. We go and do it anyhow, and we discover things. I, for the last three quarters of a year, have been on a fact-finding mission with a high-power RF. Again, getting a hold of those amplifiers, you can hear me, guys, talking about high-power solid-state amplifiers that everyone thinks no one wants, and I've been doing some minor conversion on them, applying them to my testing circuitry and measuring some things that I think are very interesting. And when we finally find out what's going on and what Mother Nature is doing here, I'm hoping to write some articles on the subject, and maybe me and a partner will even turn it into a money-making project. So it's starting off with ham radio-like equipment, using ham radio-like measurements, backed up occasionally by the laboratory of various places that I have access to, or some of my friends have got some pretty darn good test equipment, which is another point that I wanted to make, and that is you'd be amazed how many people don't get into microwave and upper VHF and UHF ham radio because they say, gee, I don't own test equipment that works there. I don't have a signal generator. I don't have a spectrum analyzer. My standing wave ratio meter doesn't go that high. And so a person branching out into one of the so-called frontier areas, one of the so-called frontier areas of ham radio, thinks that without a whole bunch of test equipment, you can't do it. Not true. Got a lot of guys have done it with no test equipment. And even if you have to go over to your friend's house 20 miles away and you visit him once a month and you use his test equipment in his basement, in many cases, that's more than good enough. All you need is one spark plug of a guy who's properly equipped, and he can be an evangelist, so to speak, a ham radio evangelist, and bring a whole lot of people up on a particular microwave ham band. NE8I, November Echo 8 India, is a guy in Michigan. I think he's in the Detroit area, but I'm not sure about that. And two-thirds of all the guys in the state of Michigan on 10 gigahertz, and is about 25 guys, are all there because of the result of the enthusiasm of NE8I. He pumps them up, he supplies them test equipment, he supplies them the components, he shows them where to get the stuff on the surplus market, how to convert them, and so on. And they run up some very nice scores in the 10 gig contest. And I've asked him when I was at the microwave update a couple of weeks ago in Philadelphia, I asked the NE8I, I've forgotten his first name, let me call him Mike. Hey Mike, what would happen if you became ill and you weren't able to support these guys? How many of them would still be on? And he thinks the answer is a relatively small number. But as long as he's alive and enthusiastic and healthy, these guys are now pursuing 10 gigs. Some of them are branching out to 22 and 47. Some of them are going down to 5 gigs. But they're having a good time and they're doing a very educational thing. They're just jumping in and saying, don't worry about the details, go and do it. As long as you're not draining the family resources and spending money that's getting the kids in trouble, so to speak, as long as you're doing things that are not harmful to people, it's an educational process, it doesn't take a whole lot of money, it just takes some time, it's a goal worth pursuing, in my opinion. So I know I'm jumping off of quite a bit to one side of what you were saying, Mel, but modeling, if it's done with enough fidelity, is capable of giving you an extremely high accuracy answer to the second or third decimal place, so to speak. If the modeling is complete enough, if the model was created by a person who's smart enough, and as long as you've got enough raw data as to the real conditions you're working under, modeling can do an extremely good job. The thing you and I've got to ask is my particular mini neck or my Yagi optimization or whatever modeling program, my HFS that I'm using, is that particular model good enough for this situation? And do I have enough accuracy of the raw data? Now, when it comes to the soil that exists on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach in Brooklyn, where Mel lives, if you cared enough, you can take a couple of samples of your soil at that surface level and maybe a couple of samples 5 feet down, bring it to the right kind of a testing laboratory, and they can tell you conductivity, dielectric constant, lost tangent, they can tell you an awful lot about your soil, how much of it is loam and how much of it is clay and so on. So if you cared enough, I didn't say you should, but if you cared enough, if you really wanted to, there are ways you can find out exactly what your soil is. And even the neighbor's soil, you'd have to sneak there at the